This is Defenders United. The gods had condemned Sisyphus to ceaselessly rolling a rock to the top of a mountain, whence the stone would fall back of its own weight. They had thought, with some reason, that there is no more dreadful punishment than futile and hopeless labor. Albert Camus, The Myth of Sisyphus. I met my first real-life public defender several years ago. I say it that way because I think, for many people, myself included, the first time we see a public defender is on Law and Order. I'm thinking of the actor Joe Grafossi. He was always in some sort of brownish suit, always with dark circles under his eyes, and never seemed too thrilled to be representing his clients. In reality, though the dark circles in frumpy suits may have been accurate, the apathetic attitude was not. On the contrary, the public defenders I've met embody that ideal talked about so often in that field, zealous defense. The kind of defense you would provide your mother or brother or best friend if they were in a bad situation and had no one else to help them. I'm a law student. I'm still learning about what it means to be an effective advocate for those who can't advocate for themselves. But nowhere in my education thus far have I learned more about how to do this than just talking to public defenders. They're fascinating human beings, people who take pride in rolling the rock up the hill, even if the gravity of the criminal justice system eventually drags it back down. Their stories should be heard, and I hope to bring many of them to you from all over the country through this podcast. But first, let's start with Brooklyn. This defender's name is Bahar Ansari, and she's worked for 11 years at Legal Aid Society. Bahar and I met in 2013. As I recall, she was filling in as catcher for the Legal Aid softball team, time served. Bahar is the person whose laugh you immediately recognize at a party. She's the person who walks into a room and, all of a sudden, the energy flows at a faster pace. She's never doing just one thing at a time, and kind of reminds me of an Italian mom in this way. Always asking, what do you need, what can I get you, how's your family, how's your love life? I trip over myself to keep up. We caught up over coffee in her office. When Bahar's parents moved to the United States just before the start of the Iranian Revolution, they ultimately settled in Reading, Pennsylvania. Her father earned his PhD in math at the University of Michigan. After finishing his program, he took a position as professor at Penn State University, the Berks campus. Bahar and I come from similar backgrounds. We both grew up in rural, predominantly white areas of Pennsylvania. We both looked unlike our peers and often served as the butt of mindless jokes about the color of our skin. We both quickly learned the art of assimilation. However, Bahar is the child of immigrants, a fact that adds another layer of complexity to her experience as a girl in Reading.
Nobody had ever even heard of an Iranian person. And it was one of those things that I immediately, as a child, wanted to hide. And now that I look back on it, it's one of those things that I'm so embarrassed about. Like, why did I do that? But, I mean, you're a kid. You want to fit in, and you want to assimilate as much as possible. But people by my name, everybody knew that I was not from, I mean, I wasn't a Jenny. I wasn't a Catherine. So everybody immediately, I remember one of my earliest memories was in kindergarten, and the kids were like, what kind of name is that? Where are you from? And I was so uncomfortable, and I was a little bit embarrassed because nobody ever knew where Iran was. So my response as a six-year-old was, I'm from overseas. Because that's where I used to hear my parents say, like, oh, we're going overseas, we're doing this. So that was my earliest memory. But a very small, white, rural, not a progressive town at all, very pretty conservative. And we were one of the very few Middle Eastern families.
For Bahar, there's a direct connection between her childhood experiences and the path she's chosen as a public defender.
I remember when I was a kid, and like I said, I really was sort of, I was different in the class in the sense that I was not from this place. I was not American, quote unquote. And I remember the kids are very cruel, and they used to make comments, and they would tease me a lot, and they would make comments about the fact that my mom has an accent and my father has an accent. And I remember really like very mean things, like saying things like, oh, towel head and stuff like that. And I sort of remember experiencing that and looking at the other kids that were there watching it and being like, why isn't anyone saying anything? Why isn't anyone like sticking up for me. And in that moment, I thought, I was like, I want to defend other people. I want to help other people. And sort of from what had happened to me, and I became sort of the person that if I saw somebody sitting by themselves in the lunch table, like I would be the one and sit with them. And because I experienced sort of that type of discrimination, in no way am I going to compare this to what my clients have gone through. Like, mm-hmm. I recognize the privilege that I have, but mm-hmm. sort of in those moments of feeling like the outcast. And I know it's so cliche that as law, you hear a lot of public defenders say, oh, I'm sticking up for the underdog. But it is true. You experience these things and you sort of feel so different and outcast, and you are the underdog, and it does make you want to stick up for somebody else. And yeah. And I never really knew exactly that I wanted to be a public defender, but I had those experiences and had those feelings and knew that there was going to be a profession out there that was going to be my calling and good for me. People ask me, where are you from or what's your religion? And I would immediately respond, well, I was raised Muslim, but I don't practice.
Right.
Like, that's like what, a justification. And you immediately have to say that as somehow that's bad or that yeah. you're a terrorist. When you experience that, then you try to remove yourself from the culture. You try to remove yourself from the religion.
After undergrad in California, Bahar came to New York as an AmeriCorps volunteer to work with court-involved kids. It was this experience that guided her decision to go to law school.
So a lot of my fellow students were from very different backgrounds, very diverse backgrounds, older, came from really, had life experiences. It's not your traditional, typical law school where everybody in the first year is 23 years old and are coming straight from undergrad and tend to be from pretty privileged backgrounds. I had this amazing clinic, and I had two great professors, Gail Gray, Steve Zeidman, and they were constantly making you think about this work, why you do it, that it's a privilege to do this work, and that the way that you approach your clients or the way you approach everybody else, you're speaking to them the way you speak to your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your mother, your father, your friend. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not, you don't have to develop some unique set of skills to talk to your clients. These are people with really intricate life stories that are complicated, like every single one of us. And through that experience, that really solidified the fact that I was meant to be a public defender. And they were inspiring. And to see lawyers that still do this level of work at such a high quality was amazing. And I had a good class.
Yeah.
I had my clinic students in the class were awesome. I'm still best friends with a lot of them.
That's so
and
nice.
What's great about most of them, they're still doing public interest work. And I don't know if a lot of law schools can say that their graduates are still doing public interest, public defender work 11 years later.
11 years later, words from her professor's teachings still circulate in her mind.
I don't remember exactly what the fact pattern was, but it was a tough fact pattern for the defense. And one of the classmates in the class said, well, you know what, I'm going to do the hearing just for discovery. And the professor Professor Gail Gray, laced into that student and said, you know what, if you're going to do it for discovery, why don't you give that case to someone that's going to try to win it?
Hmm. Wow.
And still to this day, I hear colleagues and I hear other lawyers say that, well, this is a dead loser of a case. I'm just going to do the hearing, get some discovery, and then go to the trial. And when you hear something like that, and imagine if you were a client and your lawyer is already going into this thinking they're going to lose, like, how does that make you feel?
Right.
And it makes you think about things differently. And when you do this work for as long as I have, and I've done it for 11 years, people have done it much longer, and you see different types of cases, and nothing is ever shut and dry. I've had dead loser cases going in, and then something comes around. There's something that can turn it all around, and you can win. And
yeah.
And the law is complicated, and there's always something to say or to use, and that idea of sort of just resigning yourself, of being like, well, I'm going to lose, and I'll just do this for discovery, and I don't think I would have thought about it that way had that professor not challenged that student.
Right out of law school, she was offered a position at Legal Aid's Bronx office in their Juvenile Defense Division. There, she was immediately thrown into trial work. She views the 4 years she spent there as the foundation of her current practice. By the time she moved on to adult criminal defense, she felt well-prepared and comfortable in the courtroom. Bahar transferred to Brooklyn's Criminal Defense Division as part of a hiring boom that came about due to newly passed case cap legislation that allowed legal aid to hire more attorneys. Before the legislation, attorneys' caseloads swelled to insane numbers.
Numbers were down because we were hiring so many lawyers, but before that, my colleagues tell me they were doing 120, 140 cases. They had 40 indicted felonies, which I can't even imagine. There's no way you can be an effective advocate, investigate a case, properly prepare, and counsel your client when you're representing that many people charged with serious crimes. There's no way.
Each public defense office faces unique obstacles to the defense of its clients. Although most offices struggle with insufficient funding and high caseloads, laws vary from state to state, and therefore, an attorney in one city may face challenges foreign to an attorney in another city. I asked Bahar what these challenges were for her.
Well, I think New York right now has the most archaic discovery laws in the country. We call it the blindfold law, because the way that our discovery statute is created, it allows the prosecution to withhold evidence, withhold names of witnesses, essentially until the day of trial. You are not entitled to police reports. You're not entitled to grand jury minutes. You're not entitled to witness statements. None of that until essentially right before trial.
So you can't really prepare a defense.
No. And luckily where I practice in Brooklyn does have something called open file discovery, meaning there's a stipulation between the defense bar and the DA's office that allows us to get discovery earlier. But that's because they're allowing it. It's not the law.
Wow. I mean,
when you look at other boroughs, Manhattan, the Bronx, Queens, Staten Island, you essentially really think you're blindfolded.
Yeah.
And imagine what it's like if you're a client and you're especially on serious heavy felonies, and you're saying, listen, this is the evidence that we think is against you because we don't know, but you should take 5 years. And the client rightfully is, well, can I see the grand jury minutes? Sorry, you're not entitled to it until after the jury sworn. And there's a push right now to change that. There's a big push. There's legislation, but it's the DA's office and the DA, National District Attorney Association, is powerful. And they're trying to put a spin on it and saying that if you change the discovery laws, witnesses are going to die. And there's going to be safety concerns, which is anything but the truth, because it's not like that in Brooklyn, where we have more of a liberal discovery law than other boroughs. But I think that is one of the biggest challenges facing such a progressive city like New York City. Yeah. Colleagues in other boroughs, I mean, recently the New York Times did an article where they interviewed one of my Manhattan colleagues where the client was about to take a plea, and the judge called them up to the bench. And the judge had read the grand jury minutes, because the judge in New York has to read the grand jury minutes to make sure that everything was legally proper. And the judge said, don't take the plea, go to trial. Because there was something in those grand jury minutes that had showed that the police officer was mistaken or lying and couldn't make out the crime. So they ended up going to trial and they got an acquittal.
Wow. And if the judge wouldn't have tipped him off, basically, he would have just taken the plea.
And one of my other colleagues in the Bronx had a case where they weren't giving the video of a client charged, I believe it was an assault case in the Bronx, and they weren't giving the video over. Finally, they gave it the video over, and it exonerated the client. And that client had been in jail, had lost his job, had been separated from his family, had experienced all these negative, adverse impacts. And imagine the hell of just being in Rikers Island.
Yeah.
Because they wouldn't turn over the video. Our clients have very little access to lawyers. Rikers Island, it's literally on an island. It is a pain to get to. It's hard to get there by public transportation. It's a train to a bus. And then when you go there, just the bureaucracy of lines and identification and waiting, and it is so hard to see a client. And I've had situations where I've been waiting hours to meet somebody because they're doing something there and they're stopping all movement and everything. To go to Rikers, you have to basically say that I'm not going to do anything else today. And when you're a public defender in New York City, it's hard to put that amount of time to see one client.
On January 27th, only a week after inauguration, Donald Trump issued the first travel ban through Executive Order 13769, which prohibited citizens from Iraq, Syria, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen from entry to the United States for 90 days. The executive order purported to, quote-unquote, protect the American people from terrorist attacks by foreign nationals admitted to the United States. Once again, Bahar and her family bore the brunt of xenophobia and racism promulgated by figures in the White House.
So on the day that it went into effect, I was actually in arraignments that day, because in New York, criminal courts are open every single day because individuals have to be arraigned within 24 hours of arrest. In theory, it doesn't always work that way, but that's the idea. So I was in, it was a Saturday, I was working arraignments, and I get a text from my sister-in-law saying, we're going to go to the airport, we're going to JFK, we're going to go protest, and my sister-in-law's a lawyer, too, and her husband is as well, and we're going to go help. And I remember in that moment feeling, you can't walk out of arraignments, you just can't do that, you have an obligation to your clients there in that aspect, but it was such an emotional moment for me, because all of those things that I had experienced as a child were coming back. So once again, society was looking at me as somehow like different, and I should be banned, and that I'm a threat, and that my family is a threat. I mean, my parents came here from Iran. And it really did bring that flood of emotions for me. And I live in this wonderful, very liberal city, right? And I went to all the protests. And I was around all these really great like-minded people. But I know that the rest of the country doesn't view me that way, or is not standing in solidarity with me. And in this day and age of social media, you're able to see that more. I would see posts on Facebook talking about how this is so great. Let's keep these people out. They're terrorists. I had a girlfriend that tagged me into a post where she was having an argument with this gentleman that she had gone to high school with, and back and forth. She's also a public defender, and he was, I believe, had a law enforcement background, but he was very pro the ban, and sort of tagged me so that she could have me give a perspective as an Iranian American. And it was such a futile fight, because you can just argue with these people day in and day out, and for what end? Yeah. I found myself getting so emotionally exhausted, but I found myself in one moment saying, it's so crazy to me that Trump is saying, you know, you can't come from these countries, right, because we think that you're going to, you know, cause harm. And I think about all the good things that my father did, right? He came here, he dedicated his, like, life to, like, public service as a professor teaching math. My older brother, who was born in Iran, came here and is now overseeing clinical trials for cancer drugs.
Oh.
You know, all these wonderful things. Like, I have relatives here that are, you know, physicians. That doing public service work, right? I found myself again having this argument with this guy on the internet that I've never met before, saying, you know what, people from Iran come here because they want to go to school, right? They want to do good work.
Right.
Like, they're not here to cause any harm or to bomb anything. We're not terrorists, right? But in his mind, it's this idea, well, we're just going to wait and see because we want to check you all out. And it's so hurtful because I've lived in this bubble for so many years, so all those experiences I had as, like, a child, and, you know, people making those derogatory comments, or where are you from, or, you know, all this stuff about you're different, and what language you speak, and, you know, derogatory, like, terrorism comments, everything, and it all came back, and I couldn't believe it, because, you know, we still have family there, and so many of them are here, and they come and visit, and it was very scary, you know, and it's scary especially for it to see my parents, because, you know, they're both citizens, but they came from Iran, but they've contributed so much to the society that is now saying, well, we should ban you.
We recorded our interview only several days after Charlottesville happened. The sharp contrast between the Trump administration's perception of immigrants from these countries and its defense of the white nationalists and neo-Nazis who violently lashed out at so many counter-protesters struck us as all too ironic.
They weren't called out. They weren't called terrorists at all.
No, I know. Exactly, because the way that a terrorist looks, I mean, it's somebody with a name like me or somebody that looks like my dad. I mean, that is this idea of who we've created a terrorist, and that is who our president thinks a terrorist is, and that is who his supporters think a terrorist is, and it's continuously perpetuating these stereotypes and this idea of what terror is and what isn't. I mean, I can't tell you, every time something happens and I'm like, oh my God, please let it not be like an Islamic person, because then because you start to fear, you're afraid of the backlash. Like, I remember 9/11, I was actually on a plane when the towers were hit. I was coming back from Iran. I was visiting my grandmother before she had passed away. I went back, I was 21 at the time, and I was on a flight from Amsterdam, to the U.S. and to Newark. And at that point, I was in the air when the towers hit, and they didn't tell us what had happened. They said that due to the political situation, the United States were being diverted to Montreal. They didn't want to tell us on the plane because we were going to New York, and they were afraid of, you know, people having family there. And I had no idea what was happening. I got off the plane, and I learned, and it was horrible. We were bused back, and my father had to pick me up from the Newark airport. And my father's a very proud man. And he was waiting for me, but he's a Middle Eastern man. His name's Mohammed, waiting for me at the Newark airport. Like, imagine, like, what he had to experience and the stopping. And to this day, he always wears this American flag on his suit. And because he's proud, but I'm always like, I can't believe you're, like, assimilating like this. But, mm-hmm. I mean, that's how he survives. I can't judge it. But,
yeah.
I mean, because you have to, especially in the age of Trump. You know, the thing is people are saying that they're so surprised at this country, but we have this long history. This is nothing new. We've always been like this.
I was curious as to what effects the travel ban had on Bahar's day-to-day in court.
Well, right now, every time that we have a case of a client that's a non-citizen, we're required to consult with our immigration unit. Legal Aid has excellent, excellent immigration lawyers. Most of them have done criminal law work, so they understand the issues, the intersection between criminal defendants and immigration law, and we're required to consult with them, right? Right now, the way that New York has passed a detainer law, meaning that New York is not going to cooperate with ICE. So if a client is undocumented or there's some sort of immigration hold and immigration wants to keep them, New York is not going to turn them over to immigration authorities. That wasn't always the case. When I was practicing very early on here in Brooklyn, clients that had immigration holds, after their criminal matter was terminated, they were being transferred to ICE. And there, in a civil proceeding, they were also incarcerated and they were in jails and they were not entitled to a lawyer. Very few of them had, I think, access to counsel or the resources to get counsel. But things have changed. We have that detainer law. But now, ever since Trump has become president, we do see there's so much more presence of ICE in the courtroom. So ICE is actually showing up way more than I'd ever seen before. So what's happening a lot of times is you have clients that either are undocumented or have had prior orders of removal, and ICE does show up. And we have, and this is crazy to even say this out loud, and we have asked that the judge set bail because the client would rather go into Rikers, the hell of Rikers, than to go into the custody of immigration and go back to these home countries where they don't know anybody and to be separated from families. So I don't think any advocate, any criminal defense lawyer has probably ever asked, judge, please set bail. And I don't know if you've ever heard of a client that says, okay, I'm okay with this, I'll go to Rikers. Because what will happen is they'll go to Rikers, but because the detainer law, Rikers will not turn them over to corrections, won't turn them over to immigration. So after a couple of court dates, then they'll be released.
Wow.
But that has been, I mean, the practice lately.
Wow. That's.
But we do, I mean, luckily that is, I have not encountered it, thank God, right now, but it's become our new reality in the age of Trump. But I'm not completely as well versed in immigration as my immigration colleagues, which is why we have them, but we do consult with them on every case. In terms of the travel ban, we do have a very large population from Yemen here in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Those clients, again, we have consultations with our immigration lawyers, but luckily right now I don't have any personal experience of any of them being impacted, but immigration law changes by the day, by the second. It is as complicated as tax law, so it's hard to say what's going to happen tomorrow or what's going to happen with this ban and its impact on individuals from those countries.
The Trump administration is now on its third attempt at a travel ban, after the first two versions were met with numerous legal challenges and defeats in federal court. The core argument against the previous travel bans lay in claims of religious discrimination against Muslims, as all countries included in the directives were Muslim majority. In the latest version, Trump appears to be attempting to strengthen his argument that the travel ban is not just a de facto Muslim ban, by including largely non-Muslim North Korea and Venezuela on the list of restricted countries and removing restrictions on Iraq and Sudan. In response to the new revisions, the Supreme Court has removed two cases challenging the previous travel ban from its calendar and may declare them both moot. If that happens, any new legal challenges against the revised travel ban would have to start over again in federal district court, and the Trump administration would likely ask the Supreme Court to vacate the earlier decision striking down the second version of the ban. Whether or not the inclusion of non-Muslim countries insulates the new travel ban from charges of religious discrimination remains to be seen. Parties in the Supreme Court cases have until October 5th to file new briefs, and the new ban is scheduled to take effect on October 18th. I had the pleasure of seeing Bahar on trial a couple of years back. More than anything, I was struck by Bahar's composure and tenacity in dealing with what I viewed as blatant sexism from both the district attorney and judge. I asked her more about how she manages to deal with this environment, on top of everything else.
I mean, I gotta tell you, the sexism 2017, it is real. In New York City. Very real. For me, the biggest thing for me in terms of being a female lawyer, and especially because sometimes I look young, I'm short, right? For me, and I'll talk about sort of how I deal with it first, is I've always been a big believer that you have to be prepared. I know what I'm up against. I don't have the privilege of being a white male lawyer that the whole world sees of what a lawyer looks like. They see the white male lawyer, right, walking in. I don't have that privilege, right? So I have to automatically go and enter every courtroom knowing that I have to battle like how people perceive me and how my clients perceive me and how these judges and the DAs perceive me. I mean, you are being faced with comments about your appearance constantly, comments about, hey, I've had colleagues be called lady lawyers, young lady. I've had DAs send me text messages saying, I'm going to cut your hands off because you're writing too many motions. I can tell you that not a single one of my male colleagues would ever receive a text message like that. So for me, the biggest thing, and I learned this very early on as a lawyer in the juvenile rights practice, because I did deal with a lot of sexism there, especially with some of the judges there, but I was always extremely prepared. You have to be prepared. You have to know your case. You have to know the law. There is really no room for making mistakes because you will get pounced on. And you will get pounced on more than your other colleagues, your male colleagues. So I remember specifically there was one moment where I was doing a fact-finding hearing, which is what they call trials in juvenile court, and the judge, who was a white male judge, was screaming at me, screaming to the point where it was making people in the audience so uncomfortable, just trying to argue that every question I was asking was objectionable. And I remember after I was done, one of my friends that was in the courtroom said, wow, Bahar, you handled that so well. It's like it didn't even faze you. You did not even wince. And I wasn't trying to be like that. There's something that happens. And I think that you put up this front, right? And you're being screamed at, but you know that you have to keep going. And I'm relentless. And it's something that I've learned to be is relentless. And I believe in being very respectful. Like, I'm not going to lose my cool or lose my shit. Can I say shit?
Yeah, you can say shit.
Like, I'm not going to lose my shit in there, but I've developed the sort of controlled rage with it, because I can't lose my shit, right? Because I'm going to be treated differently than another lawyer, right? It's just not how it is. It wasn't that I had sort of put my game face on purpose. It was inside of me, and it was sort of who I've learned to become, and it's how you deal with this work. And I know this summer when I tried this very serious, three TPO attempted murder case. It was a month-long trial, and I tried it with a male colleague who I respect. But the differences between how he and I were treated, I'll tell you, in the beginning of that trial, I had a water bottle on the table, and the jury wasn't even there, and the judge had said, Ms. Ansari, you need to remove that water bottle. Which, of course, I know to remove the water bottle. I would never have water like that on the table and when the jury comes out, but fast forward probably a month later, it's the jury is out deliberating. My colleague comes in. He has his Starbucks cup, and he puts it on the table. We're talking, we're arguing with the judge about what readbacks we're going to agree to. And I look at him, and I'm like, I can't believe no one's saying anything about his Starbucks on the table. Which, you get, it's sad to say, but in a way, you sort of, it's all you ever know.
Yeah.
It's who I am, it's all I ever know. And this is, and the things that I've experienced are nothing what a lot of my my African-American colleagues here have experienced. They're being told, you can't sit in the front row. Only lawyers. Well, I am a lawyer. So I won't even begin to speak about the microaggressions that are experienced by my colleagues, that not only by judges, but DAs, but also by their own criminal defense public defender colleagues. I mean, it's real.
Bahar recently accepted a fellowship at her alma mater, CUNY, where she'll teach and mentor current law students in the very same clinic she did years ago.
Well, right now, I'm not a public defender in the traditional sense, meaning that I'm not carrying a caseload, I'm not in a trial office, but I was very, very lucky and very fortunate to have received this opportunity to go and teach in the criminal defense clinic, the very clinic at CUNY that sort of shaped me and made me become the lawyer that I am today, but to teach in that clinic for a year. It's the first year where the criminal defense clinic has created a fellowship to allow a practitioner to come and teach.
It's amazing.
For a year, so they send out applications for a legal aid lawyer specifically, since CUNY and Legal Aid have a partnership, to go and supervise the students that are doing a 12-credit clinic where they're picking up actual misdemeanor cases. So I'm going to be supervising them. So I've taken a leave of absence from legal aid.
Oh my God. The
first time in my career, I have transferred all my cases, and I do not carry a caseload, but I have to tell you, it stays with you. The anxiety doesn't go away overnight when you don't have cases. You're still thinking about your clients and hoping they're still in good hands.
I bet. But what a really wonderful way to come full circle.
I have to say, it is the most exciting thing. I mean, I've been doing this work for so long, for 11 years. And I mean, I say so long, but I don't know if some of your listeners are probably like, I've been doing this for 30 years. I don't know who's going to be listening to this, but to me, it seems like a very, very long time. It's so excited now to be in a position where I can teach students sort of everything that I've learned over the years. Mm-hmm. And that's what's exciting for me. And what's exciting, too, is that I want students and I want law students to know and realize that you can still be a public defender for a really long time and still sustain a high level of practice. And that these ideas of burnout are very real. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to sugarcoat that. But you can still do this work, and you can still do this work well, like years, years later. But it comes from deep inside of you. And I always tell people, when I interview lawyers to go legal aid, and I always tell people, I go, if this is not in your heart, if this is not what you want, don't do it. Because there are so many people that want to do this work, and our clients deserve lawyers. Because how are you ever going to convince a jury to care about your client if you don't care?
Right.
Like, it's just not. It's these ideas that sort of, it's so ingrained in you, and that if I always tell people, if you want to just be a trial lawyer, like, this isn't going to be for you.
Yeah.
Because trials are few and far between. If you're going to define success by winning a case, then you're not going to last, because very, very few cases go to trial, and these acquittals that you get, like the euphoria, very few of them happen. And when you get your acquittal, the euphoria probably lasts 20 minutes because you're on to the next case.
Right.
It's funny because I always tell myself, like, I'll get an acquittal, I'll be so excited, but then the next morning I'll find myself, like, bitching about something else and, like, angry or doing another fight. And I'm like, why can't you just live in that excitement? But you just can't, because
it's
there's
brief.
Always another fight to fight. There's always another battle to engage in.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But you learn in this job to really define success differently.
Yeah.
Like, in different ways. Because people think, oh, you're a trial lawyer, it's like all about arguing in front of a jury. No, not really. I mean, sometimes I define success recently because one of my clients who's in jail, his mother had sent him a care package, and she'd saved money to buy him these Puma sneakers. And she had called the – she did everything right. She called the jail to make sure that they were authorized, that they weren't against code. She sent them to him. She called me so upset, saying he got everything in that care package except those sneakers. I was so upset. I had emailed our prisoner rights project, and they did such a great job, and they sent an email and we to all the relevant players at Department of Corrections, and I saw my client a few days later when I visited him. He had the sneakers on. I was so excited. I was like, you got your sneakers! And to me, it was such a small, small thing, right? To just get somebody their sneakers back. But it was so important to the family that that alone, there's your success. Like, that's another success that you get excited about.
I was eager to hear what advice Bahar had for students like myself who are interested in pursuing a career in public defense. Did she wish she could have done things differently? What would she have told the Bahar who was just starting out as a juvenile defense attorney in the Bronx?
I don't know about if I would have done anything differently. I think we all have a lot of regrets in life, right? And we look back and we wish we would have done things differently. But what's funny about me is that I think the one part of my life that I'm not really regretting is how I did my career. I think for me it was important, having gone to juvenile rights, even though I didn't want to at first, and having litigated very heavy cases. But I think that the one thing, though, I wish that I would have done over the years that I will tell the listeners is that don't be so hard on yourself. I have spent so much time over the years being so hard on myself, and you lay awake at night. I should have done this. I should have done that. I should have asked this question, or I should have phrased the opening this way, or I should have submitted this pre-pleading memorandum earlier. Maybe things would have been different. And I think that you have to really trust yourself, especially when you start doing very serious cases. Because when you're dealing with cases where you're talking about people being sent to jail for the rest of their life, you really second guess yourself. And that it is this idea of playing poker with someone else's chips that really freaks you out, but you have to stay grounded and you have to be kind to yourself. You have to trust yourself. And I've been so hard on myself over the years, especially when I was first starting out. And I think if I could go back and see the younger Bahar, I would have said, just calm down, you're doing okay.
I feel like every public defender needs to hear that multiple times. You know, throughout the day, because it's such rough work.
It is such work, because you're always so worried. You're like, this one mistake, is this going to...
Yeah.
This could alter the path of somebody else's life.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is going to be an unpopular thing to say, but I think that a lot of prosecutors go into the work thinking that, I'm going to be the good prosecutor. I'm going to have sort of discretion. Do what you want to do. I've never wanted to tell people, don't follow what you think your path should be or what your career goal should be, but you should be true to what's going to happen. And I think that prosecutors go into this work a lot of times thinking that they have a lot more autonomy than they do. But I'd like them all to know that you have a boss and your bosses are watching, and that while you may go into this work thinking that you're going to advocate for change and you're really going to be there to put true criminals in jail, it's not. I mean, at the end of the day, they're political people and they have agendas, mm-hmm. and that they should know that. And that sort of autonomy that they think they have, I don't think they're not going to have it. I would hope that the future prosecutors that are listening to this, I would hope that they understand that we are all more than our worst mistakes. And that I want them to, and I always tell this to people when they ask why I do this work. I said, imagine if you did the worst thing you ever did, right? But for the rest of your life, people were constantly talking about it. And they were constantly judging you about it, right? And you're saying, no, well, I'm a good mother. I'm a good student. I'm a good basketball player. Like, all these other things. But they're still obsessed with that one bad thing you did. And they're not hearing and they're not listening to all these wonderful other things you did. Like, imagine how that feels. And that's how our clients are feeling every day in the system. And I think that if they could be open to that and open to hearing stories, like I said, I go, these are very, very complicated people, like all of us. We all have stories. And the choices that we make don't necessarily make us bad people. There are things that are beyond our control, and that we have to be cognizant of privilege and racism. And racism in this country is deep.
Keeping in touch with the world outside law school is something all law students struggle with, especially the first year. Bahar gave some great advice on how law students can stay connected to the causes we care about.
Clients are not entitled to lawyers in most areas, right? Housing, immigration, even when the police want to take your car after you get arrested, you're not entitled to a lawyer in that proceeding. If you're a child that gets arrested and your school suspends you, you're not entitled to a lawyer in that suspension proceeding, right? But they need advocates, and there's so much room for law students to advocate for individuals that have these collateral issues. And I hate sometimes using the word collateral because it sort of minimizes what it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's actually a lot of what we call collateral consequence, the client would say, no, that's actually a direct consequence to my life.
Yeah.
But, I mean, especially in New York, I mean, we need law students to help represent students in suspension hearings, represent our clients whose licenses are taken away because of an arrest. And these administrative proceedings, I mean, there's so much room for law students to litigate and advocate.
I'm really interested in what keeps public defenders going day after day in a system that does not view their clients as human. Bahar told me about her worst day and how she kept going after.
Gosh, I gotta tell you, the worst day ever was I had to stand next to, I had that case that I did last summer where, which is funny because we won one of the attempted murder charges, actually one and a half of them. I mean, it was a victory, but it was a Pyrrhic victory because the sentencing guidelines were so high, because we live in this sort of society that is so punishment oriented. Mm-hmm. Everything is about punishing people. We don't look at this idea that we are capable of redemption and change, especially as people get older. We have so many old people in jail.
Yeah.
Right? We have to make a law for everything. There's a law to punish everybody for everything, right? So the hardest and the day was this client that I had worked so hard. And I was saying earlier about how when you start to do more serious cases, you start to second guess yourself more because you're like, if I screw this up, this could alter somebody else's life, right? The pressure it's intense. But when I had to do this hearing where the DA wanted to send him to jail for life because of his priors, and I had advocated to a point where I have to tell you, I am at peace for the work that I did. I did give zealous representation. And it was so hard because he got a sentence of, I had to stand next to somebody that got a sentence of 55 to life. Like, he will see the parole board when I'm 80 years old. It is, when I think about it, I can't even articulate sort of the immense emotions that happen when you are, I don't like to say the word in charge, but sort of directing a case where somebody is exposed to that much jail time. But the hardest moment was not even the day that he got that sentence. It was the letter that came in the mail 2 weeks after he had been sentenced. And I got the letter from him, and my immediate thought was, oh, here we go. He's going to try to say that I was ineffective or something. And I opened it, and it was the nicest letter I had ever received from a client, and I had been practicing for 11 years. I have walked people out of jail, and I've never gotten a letter like this. And this individual, one of the nicest clients I've ever had, because, and whoever goes into this work will know, you meet people that are accused of doing horrible, horrible things, but you get to know them as people and their families. And nice, very nice guy, and we had developed this great relationship over the time. And he had sent me this letter saying, thank you for everything that you did. You stuck up for me. You never ended the fight. He's like, you sent me every motion. I was so involved in this case. And he was like, I knew what we were up against. And he's you never gave up. And he goes, and I have never been compelled to write a letter like this to any of the lawyers that I've had over the years. And I received the worst possible outcome. It was the hardest day. I get teary, I get very emotional thinking about it, but it was so hard because at that point, the sentence had been handed down. There was nothing more I could do. And you get so hopeless, right? What else can I do? I mean, you do the appeal, but somebody else does the appeal. And in a way, it's worse because it was as if he was saying, Bahar, it's going to be okay. Thank you. It was as if he was telling me that everything was going to be fine. But I've had a lot of hard days, but I got to tell you that to me right now, as you asked me that question, I cried and I think about it often. I would be lying if I didn't say they didn't go by that I don't think about that case. I still should have done this. I should have done that.
I find myself thinking quite often about how to best convince the most conservative people I know that we should care about the people who are labeled criminals by our society, that we should question why they are labeled criminals in the first place. I often think about how they would answer the question, if your family or friends were swooped up by the police one day, how would you want them to be treated? Bahar had some interesting thoughts on the subject.
It's Netflix. Netflix can change the whole criminal justice system. That's my answer. Because that's what everyone's watching.
Right.
It always shocked me after Making a Murderer. People would tell me, oh my God. I mean, the thing is, it's always hard for me because I have this argument all the time with my friend, one of my dear, dear friends, because she is one of those people that's always like trying to check people constantly. And I always tell her, they're not listening to you. You can't check everybody. You can't get everybody to care. But she's eternally, eternally optimistic. And I admire her for that. And I love it. And I love to sort of to watch her and hear her engage in these conversations with people that are never going to change, right? I don't know about the idea of getting people to change. I mean, I think that things are being broadcast more out there. And I don't know if it's because of us in these trial offices. I think, sadly, people are on Netflix all day long and they're watching Making of the Murderer, and then all of a sudden they're like, oh my God, there's false confessions? Which we in the industry have known for years. Like, it is a true and rare thing, but people all of a sudden are watching these, like, documentaries on Netflix and are like, oh my God, innocent people are going to jail, or what happened with the Central Park Five and with DNA and everything. I mean, for me, I don't know if I can get people to change. I think it's, I tell people all the time, I think that if you care about, like, sort of the system, the justice system, right, and the way that we're set up, like, answer your jury summons. When you get it in the mail, don't say, oh, shit, I gotta go to jury duty. Like, answer it and go. Don't try to make something up and get out of it. And people will be surprised. Every juror I've ever had on a case has always said to me, it was such a good experience. Like, that is what sort of makes this country and what sets us apart. I mean, the way that a lot of countries are set up is like, no, you are really guilty until proven innocent. And I'm not saying our system's perfect at all, but we do have that beautiful part of it. And one of the big things we always try to say, like, when you pick a jury, you ask questions, right, to decide if they're going to be fair and partial. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions that a lot of people like to ask jurors is, imagine if you got a phone call in the middle of the night that your loved one was arrested, right? If I called you Mr. Doe and said, your wife was accused of slashing her boss, what would you say? Usually the jurors, that can't be the case. No way. She's not like that. That juror has demonstrated a presumption of innocence, like right there, right? But that's because it's their own family member. It's because of that sort of emotional connection they have to that person. But most people don't necessarily see our clients that way, right? They're sitting in a defense table, sometimes with a court officer behind them because they're incarcerated. They have a defense lawyer. Sadly, a lot of the defense lawyers tend to be white men sitting next to them. And it's an automatic, what did that person do, right? But you have to spin it. And it's the things that we would want for ourselves and our family members. Like, imagine, like, you want to put that on everybody.
Camus ended his story about Sisyphus with these words. I leave Sisyphus at the foot of the mountain. One always finds one's burden again. But Sisyphus teaches the higher fidelity that negates the gods and raises rocks. He too concludes that all is well. This universe henceforth without a master seems to him neither sterile nor futile. Each atom of that stone, each mineral flake of that night-filled mountain, in itself forms a world. The struggle itself towards the heights is enough to fill a man's heart. One must imagine Sisyphus happy. I guess public defenders like Bahar, who have been doing the work for a significant period of time, all have one thing in common. Like Sisyphus, they have found joy in rolling the rock up the hill. In our next episode, we'll speak to an attorney who is all too familiar with this struggle as a public defender in New Orleans. His name is Will Snowden, and in addition to being a supervising attorney at Orleans Public Defenders, he's also founder of the Juror Project, a nonprofit focused on juror education and diversity. To hear more about his story, tune in next time on Defenders United. That was from Brooklyn. Defenders United is produced by me, Gabriella Ferrara, through the support of Georgetown Defenders and the Georgetown Voice. Sound editing by Nicholas Gavio. Research by Andrew Robinson. Theme music by Mike Pate, trial attorney at Legal Aid Brooklyn. Special thanks to Bahar Ansari and Legal Aid Society Brooklyn. Visit www.georgetowndefenders.wordpress.com for episode transcripts, photos, and more. A lot of things have